The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating 50 years of promoting greater awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org.
On April 10th, 2008, the Korea Society hosted the Republic of Bloggers, a panel discussion on the blogging cultures of the United States, Korea, and Japan, and their relationships with participatory democracy.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Daniel Levine, and I'd like to welcome you to the Korea Society. In the late 1980s, technology, namely desktop publishing, brought the ability to self-publish to anyone with a computer and a laser printer. But recently, the emergence of a new form of publishing, blogging, has brought the barriers to entry crashing down for self-publishing. Anyone with access to the internet can use a variety of tools, most of them free, to post their thoughts and comments to a worldwide audience. Many, if not most, of these blogs are filled with pictures of first birthday parties and videos of sneezing pandas. Others have become important outlets for social commentary, news, and politics. But in either case, the ability to self-publish to a globally networked audience has the ability to change how we relate to each other as friends, coworkers, and citizens. Tonight, we present the Republic of Bloggers, a panel discussion focusing on the blogging phenomenon in the United States, Korea, and Japan, and its impact on citizenship and civil society. And now I'd like to introduce our panel. Devin Stewart is the director of the Global Policy Innovations Program at the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs. He is also an active blogger, being the publisher of Fair Globalization and Ethical Blogger, and he directs several projects, including workshops for ethics and business and assessing Asians' relations with China and Japan. He holds a graduate degree from Johns Hopkins University. David Weinberger currently serves as a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. He was a senior internet advisor for Howard Dean's 2004 presidential campaign and provided technology policy guidance for John Edwards' 2008 presidential campaign. You can find his writing at johotheblog.com. And his most recent book is Everything is Miscellaneous, The Power of the New Digital Disorder. His PhD is from the University of Toronto. Tobias Harris is a freelance journalist, the author of Observing Japan, a blog that focuses on Japanese politics and East Asian international relations. He has extensive experience in Japanese politics, having worked there as a political aide, and his articles have been published in the Far Eastern Economic Review, the Wall Street Journal Asia, and the Japan Times. Stuart Thorson is a professor at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University in New York, where he directs the Interdisciplinary Graduate Certificate Program in Information Technology, Policy, and Management. He teaches politics and governance in the information age. He is a board member of the Korea Society. His PhD is from the University of Minnesota. Wendy H.K. Chun is an associate professor of modern culture and media at Brown University. She is the author of Control and Freedom, Power and Paranoia in the Age of Fiber Optics, and co-editor of New Media, a history and theory reader. Her PhD is from Princeton University. Samuel Jamier is the Senior Program Officer for Contemporary Issues and Corporate Affairs here at the Korea Society. He writes our popular Korea Society film blog and has lived in both Korea and Japan. He holds graduate degrees from Tokyo University, King's College in London, and the Sorbonne Nouvelle University in Paris. Please join me in welcoming our panelists. If you're wondering about blogging, we have an expert written a number of books on it, has advised for political campaigns, and he's going to give us a background on blogging and what it means in the United States.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Expert on blogging sounds like an oxymoron to me, but I'm going to push ahead anyway. So uh, I my role, apparently, in these opening remarks is I'm going to talk about what blogs are, but at a really abstract, unsatisfying level. So, and as I'm glad you mentioned right at the beginning that I'm writing from the point of view as an American. I make no, I have no pretensions about understanding blogs to any depth in any other part of the world. So, sorry. What are blogs? Well, you know, you can ask various people. And if you look at Clay Shirky, who teaches not too far from here, a few years ago he posted an article that has become very well known, in which he pointed out that the popularity of blogs, that measured by the number of links going into them, forms a power law curve. It has a steep head and then a long, long, long tail. And so Shirky pointed out that there are actually very few bloggers who have lots of readers, but they have lots and lots of readers, and there's a sudden elbow in the curve, and then there's tens of millions of bloggers who have a handful of readers. And so one of Clay Shirky's points was that, you know, blogs actually have become a lot like the media. If you have 100,000 people, 500,000 people reading your blog, you cannot respond to all their email. It becomes a one-way medium, just like broadcast media. And, of course, lots of people got upset about this because it seemed to deny the democratizing effect that people had been hoping for from blogs. So if you're Clay Shirky, if you look at this and you see a power law, you see this curve, then blogs look like media. If you are a journalist, then when you look out at blogs, and this has historically been the case in the past 6 or 7 years, journalists look at blogs and see reporters, except reporters without editors and reporters without codes of conduct and without ethical systems, without codes of ethics, that which I think we are going to hear more in a bit. If you are a parent, then the blogging that your children are doing looks like public diaries done without locks. So these are three actually very different, and there are other views as well, of course. For example, that it's self-publishing, and that, which has an audience, and that's a different type of framing of what blogs are. So what are blogs? Well, you know, asking what people write on blogs is a lot like asking what people write on paper. They write every sort of thing on paper. But that's, and while that's true, I think it's just a bit disingenuous of me, because blogs actually do have some properties that some affordances, if you will, that help shape what they are. They're not simply blank paper. Paper also has its own affordances. Blogs have a different set. So there's a set of characteristics you can look at for blogs. And one is that there's a temporal quality to them. That is, typically, they're written, bloggers write every day. They post every day. That, you know, that's what you're supposed to do. So, and because of that, that's a lot of time, it's a lot of pressure, and so blogs tend to be short. Not always, but frequently, blog posts typically are fairly short postings. So all of this is highly generalized, of course, but that's one of my points. But nevertheless, because of the temporal nature of blogs, the postings tend to be short, and that has an effect on the nature of the argument that occurs in blogs, for example. Because you're, again, another temporal aspect, because you are writing them in them every day, they have a certain, and they are persistent. You can always go back and re-find in this series, this long stream of blogs, you can read the previous blogs the person has written. This can help provide a context for what the writer says, and many bloggers depend upon readers having been there before to understand the blogger's tone of voice and quirks and how much overstatement she does or whatever. Another temporal aspect of blogs is that because we write every day in them, we tend to write quickly, which means that we don't always spell check. We don't always check facts. We don't always make sense. They're not the perfect thing that we would have written if we had time, much less editors. But this actually has a couple of I think, good effects. One is that they encourage this quickness of writing encourages a type of transparency so that you blurt out where you stand so that what you're saying can be understood by somebody who is reading as quickly as you're writing. And it's quite common for, it's quite unusual, in fact, for bloggers not to be transparent about their own standpoint, their own prejudices, their own political, if that bears on it, their own political point of view. And also because of the quickness with which we write our posts, we don't spell check. Our fallibility, the fact that we're imperfect, shows up in every blog post just about, or in many of them. We rely as bloggers upon our readers' understanding that we're writing quickly and first drafts and that this is imperfect. This type of fallibility creates a type of intimacy between the blogger and the reader that simply doesn't exist in the more polished forms of writing that are handled, that are created by writers with editors, writers with codes of professional conduct, writers who have fact checkers and all the rest of it. All those things are great, but there's also room in the world for quick writing that exhibits and acknowledges human fallibility and that creates a type of intimacy that between reader and author that is exactly what you do not get in the mass media. Blogs are full of links, typically full of links to other posts, to the mainstream media, to other stuff. And every one of those links is a little act of generosity. It's a little act of selflessness in which the blogger says, please go away from my page. Glad you're reading my page. Very happy you're here. But here's something else that will make you laugh, that will annoy you, something that's so wrong, something that's so right. It's interesting enough that I'm going to comment on it, and I'm going to link to it, and I want you to go away. This little act of selflessness is, again, the antithesis of what we've gotten on corporate sites and at least initially in mainstream media sites, which thought that they succeeded by sticking our eyeballs to the page, a phrase that marketers use all the time, sticky eyeballs, the most disgusting and degrading way of talking about the people you're writing to. Nevertheless, if that's what you're trying to do, then you won't put any links in. But if you're a blogger, you will send people away all the time on purpose. And so this actually leads to a sense of blogs, I think, overall as more than simply things that we publish and things that we say. For one thing, the persistence, the temporal quality of blogs, the fact that you can read a stream of them from a single blogger, they're there, they're made easy to find, make blogs into something more than, makes them special, is what I'm trying to say. That for many of us, blogs are our presence on the web. They are the chief and central way we are on the web. They are ourselves on the webs, or to be more exact, blogs for many of us are like our bodies on the web, what give us a persistent location in cyberspace. They are our bodies, and when you attack them, you are attacking us. That's why we respond with some degree of ferocity when we're attacked in ways that don't seem to be simply commentary on the what we've written. And second of all, because blogs are so tightly linked, linking back and forth and all over the place, they become, in many cases, not always, but in many cases, a type of community is a little too strong. It's more like a conversation. That's not quite the right word either, but there's something social about them. And to read them simply as letters to the editor published into the great gaping void of the internet is to miss the social aspect of blogs, where we get to know who our readers are. We feel a sense of commitment to our readers. Our readers treat us as somebody that they know because, indeed, they do. They've been reading us for 6 months, a year, 5 years. That's what's missing in Clay Shirky's vision of the long tail, which focused a lot of attention on the head of the tail because that stuff looks like media. But the long tail of tens of millions of bloggers, nobody knows how many, but it's tens and tens of millions of bloggers who have four or five links going into them and probably a handful of readers. Those readers are typically engaged, and what's going on there is not a series of dots, a series of unread or little red letters to the editor or little red op-eds or little red public diaries. What's going on there are knotty, twisty, intimate relationships among bloggers and their readers trailing off over time and knotting up over time as well. So blogs, fundamentally, from my point of view, the importance of them socially is that they are indeed not so much publications as small societies. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Tonight's program is co-presented with the Japan Society and also the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs. The program is actually part of their Ethical Blogger Project, which is conducted by Brown University's Watson Institute, the Carnegie Council for Ethics, DEMOS, NYU Center for Global Affairs, Oxford University's Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism, the Japan Society, and the Korea Society. And David and Stewart has some remarks about the project and why you should go check it out.
Thank you very much. Last week we had the first iteration of the Ethical Blogger meetings. We were hoping to conduct them all around the world. And our goal is simply to instill a sense of ethics into a very powerful tool, which is blogging. Often, when we came up with this idea, it was actually Steve Clemens of The Washington Note, a very well-known blog, actually came up with the idea of the Ethical Blogger Project. Initially, we said, try it on to some experts. Ethical Blogger, ethics and blogging. Is this a viable project? And many people said, they have nothing to do with one another. And I'm just here to give you a brief overview of why I believe that ethics has everything to do with blogging. Blogging should be informed and guided by a sense of ethics, because everything we do as people has consequences. Another question says, some of the bloggers on Steve's Washington Note asked, why don't you focus on lobbying or corporate corruption or the Iraq War instead of bloggers? Why are you picking on bloggers? Well, we have projects about those things too. But I just would like to assert that blogging does affect everyone. It has consequences for nonprofits, for corporations, for governments, and for the mainstream media. And sometimes it's life or death. Just in the U.S.-Japan framework, I'm more of a Japan specialist in my background, so I'm just going to focus a bit on that, is a phenomenon that I think Harris might talk about later, is cyberbullying, which is called cyberbullying. I think there's a Wikipedia page now on that phenomenon alone. And in Japan, there was a stabbing, as you might know, as a result of bullying online. This was in 2006. In 2004, in an elementary school. In the United States, many of you might know about the famous suicide of Megan Mayer in 2006 over a boyfriend, which was actually fabricated by neighbors of Megan's, and she found out that things didn't work out so well. So, in fact, there is a whole Wikipedia page about this episode alone, and hundreds of posts, mostly very angry about this episode, blaming the parents who allowed this fabricated identity. Now, I'm going to give you two short stories about the Ethical Blogger blog. These aren't necessarily profound in any way, but this is... The Ethical Blogger Project has a blog, and I invite you to visit it, and please participate. That's what it's all about. Two stories that we have observed on the blog that sort of touch on some of the key issues here. One is a New York school teacher who wrote in about a posting I did about anonymity. Anonymity happens to be an issue I'm fairly passionate about. I think it's very a good starting point to examine anonymity, when it's appropriate, when it's not appropriate. And what it means. And she wrote a very heartfelt story on our blog, saying that she wrote an op-ed in some forum, and she was punished as a school teacher for writing with her name and her email address. And she, I have actually her blog post here. She wrote, "I hate the feeling that in this country, the United States, a supposedly free country, that people must hide behind anonymous names." And she goes on, and I went back to actually capture her post today for this talk, and I couldn't find it. So I'm guessing she might have actually deleted her post. I just have an excerpt. I happen to have an excerpt that I had taken earlier. So in a sort of strange way, where I initially asserted on the blog here that if you live in an oppressive society or an oppressive climate or environment where you're threatened, that might justify anonymous blogging. In China, sometimes anonymity is seen as credibility, ironically, because in China, if you post anonymously, you're not part of the establishment. You're not a mouthpiece. But in our free and just United States, there are also times when many people on the blog have made a case for anonymity. A second story is about beauty pageant winners. Many of you have seen Little Miss Sunshine. Think of that, okay? This is a true story. As far as we know, it's true. Everyone who claims, who talked to us about it, claims this is a true story. The blog posting on the Ethical Blogger a few months ago, there was a post on there from a family, and it said simply, "What if I'm not who I write I am? What if I'm not really this person?" I thought that was kind of odd. It was about anonymous posting and stuff, but why would someone point at themselves as being, you know, having a fake identity? Turns out, a few weeks later, a mother calls me and says her daughter was the winner of a Florida beauty pageant, and the losers of the pageant, their parents, started a fake identity pretending to be the parents of the winners. And they went around the internet sprinkling weird comments and had this blog and a whole identity that they fabricated. And this woman called me up and said, "Can you please take down the post? I didn't write it. It has my name there." And I think the reason I bring this up is because as publishers, bloggers are publishers, we have a duty to stand by the effects and the accuracy of what is up there. It's often said that you can be a global publisher within 2 minutes. And we think of the Spider-Man quote, right? "With great power comes great responsibility." That's all I'm trying to say here. Now, a few points that came up in last week's conference I just want to touch on real quick. I know we're running out of time. One is the ethic of the link, which is came up earlier. There is a certain tension, a sort of interesting tension, I think, in the two principles of the Internet. The Internet was formed as a way to link and exchange data. So connectivity is scientifically the most Internet-ist it can be. It's being the most Internet. And at the same time, bloggers have an effect of being journalists. So there is a sort of interesting tension there between being connected and being sort of a journalist and having those responsibilities and the power. And as was mentioned earlier, you know, newspapers failed in some ways to simply get that. They at the beginning stages, they simply put their newspapers online, an online newspaper, with no links to the outside world, no activity, nothing at all. But that might change. Next is a big point is identity. We were really fortunate to have dinner the night before with Philip Rosedale, the founder of Second Life, who's indirectly part of this effort. And what he was saying basically at dinner was you are in charge of your online identity. And in an interesting way, maybe you could call it a Rawlsian way, you know, there is some justice that you have control of who you are rather than the you that you were born with. So which one is the more you? Well, Phil Rosedale thinks that there's a case to say that the you that you're in charge of is in some way more you than the one that you're born with. The trick and the problem is that people bifurcate or fragment their identities online, and they'll have many different identities. They'll have a party Phil, you know, a nice Phil, a mean Phil, and, you know, the different one will come out given the situation. But that prevents society from holding that Phil accountable because there are many different ones. Maybe they look different in Second Life. Maybe they have different, you know, jargon or different tone. And so in thinking about, over lunch today, I was thinking about this, and over, you know, thinking about the actual utility, the social utility of having online identities, I thought about whether it's more like two sorts of models. It's actually probably both. But is it a threatening, anonymous person who's destroying things? And I thought of the Ku Klux Klan is one type, archetype you could think of, or is it more like a costume party where you're trying on different types of costumes, role-playing perhaps, to exercise various, you know, things that you have in your head or you want to try out, you're experimenting. Maybe it's a little bit of both, maybe both are possibilities. Finally, I just want to mention briefly about the effect of new media on journalism. As some of you might know, there was a recent study from the Project for Excellence in Journalism, and if you take out Iraq, Iran, Pakistan, those three stories, right, the whole rest of the world's the world news from all the rest of the world only accounted for 6% of U.S. news. So Cass Sunstein, the scholar, legal scholar, talks about group polarization, which means that people kind of congeal into like-minded people online, on blogs, for example, and they amplify their extremism. He says it sort of promotes extremism. Well, I'd like to try to coin a little piggyback term. How about news polarization? You know, news is becoming more and more demand-driven, and it's responding to these congealed communities online. And what you get as an unfortunate result is a narrowing of the news. Question is, how does our democracy fare as a result? Thank you.
You talked about the example with the school teacher and also the cyberbullying. I know that companies these days are struggling with the fact that their employees talk about what happens at the company online. And I think even in Korea, there was some legislation introduced to combat cyberbullying. Is the Ethical Blogger Project a place where people can go to get some guidance or discussion on? Could you explain how that works?
Absolutely. And I think we might get into this later, but you know, there are various codes of conduct, ethical codes of conduct or code of blogging ethics, COBE, as it's sometimes referred. And this is a very active debate. The ethical blogger is simply a place to discuss it. It's not a place to tell you what to do, other than to think about it and to realize that you do have a lot of power. We were called Blog of Note by Google Blogspot, and we've generated quite a discussion there. In fact, I could probably write a book alone. That's the cool thing about blogging, is that you learn from the people out there. And that might be, you know, one of the big questions is can newspapers compete with the world on reporting, right? I mean, journalists are just a handful of people. The blogosphere is theoretically infinite. There's a lot of expertise out there.
Tobias, you have special insights into Japan.
I guess I should add... move that down a little bit. I should add a disclaimer to start. I'm a Japanese politics specialist who happens to blog. I'm not an expert on blogging or on ethics. I mean, I've come to this from having looked at how the role the media plays in politics in Japan, looking at internet and blogging. So I'm coming from that perspective, not from the general perspective of blogging. So with that out of the way, I'm going to just break down my discussion to two parts. First, I'll talk about kind of Web 2.0 politics in Japan and the role it plays, if any. And then I'll talk about my own experiences as a blogger, because I'm a English language blogger about a foreign country's politics, which I guess is kind of a unique thing. I can talk about that. So I'll put that at the end. So to start, first, in the notice about this talk, it noted the announcement said something about how, according to a Washington Post article, Japan has more blogs than any other place. And actually, there's been a story now going around started by originally a study done by Nifty, a Japanese web portal, which found that actually 40% of that survey actually turns out to be spam blogs, not actual blogs, just sites used for advertising revenue. So we're not talking about numbers here, and it's hard to know what the true number is. So I don't actually really want to talk about that. I'm more interested in what role blogs can play, or YouTube, or these other Web 2.0 mechanisms can play in Japanese politics. And so really, just to put my opinion out front, I don't think they play much of a role at all in Japanese politics. I mean, there are all sorts of little things, and you usually see stories in English language media about them when they come up. Japanese politics write blogs. Some of them are very good. There's one in particular by a LDP member of the upper house, which is extraordinary, and he provides real insight to how, you know, the life of a politician and what's actually happening within the LDP and what's happening in the Diet debates. I mean, it's very helpful. You have, and this actually got coverage in English language media as well, that the LDP created its own YouTube channel late last year, and people were talking about this and what this means. And actually, one other thing that got, I think maybe it was in the Washington Post, New York Times, but a deep opposition member of the upper house in advance of last summer's elections actually set up an office in Second Life. And so people were talking about what this means for Japan and Web 2.0 politics and so on. But I actually think these examples show you just how limited these mechanisms are in Japanese politics. Looking at the LDP's YouTube channel, I mean, after all the initial excitement about it, it's actually turned into pretty much just a channel for disseminating propaganda. If you go look at the videos there, I mean, there's none of the kind of interaction with viewers. There's no real commentary. It's just the LDP puts up some kind of video, you know, saying whatever it wants to, and it's not really a two-way flow of communication. It's pretty much one way. And as for the campaign office in Second Life, interestingly enough, it had to be shut down in July before the upper house elections because it would have been in violation of Japan's campaign laws. So with that in mind, I think that actually sets the tone for what kind of role these mechanisms play in Japanese politics. And so there are two problems. And the first, as the Second Life incident shows, that Japanese campaign laws are highly restricted. I mean, the ways Japanese politicians are able to campaign, the ways they can interact with voters, you have restrictions that you just don't see in the United States. To make that comparison, there are certain places that you can put up your posters. There are certain times when you can put up your posters. There are only certain ways you can speak to voters. You have to have flyers that are within certain dimensions that can only have certain images. It tends to be very much old-fashioned. You know, there are a lot of phone calls, a lot of direct mailing, but it's not 21st century campaigning that we've seen, and I'm certain that you saw in your own campaign experiences here and trying to explore new ways of interacting with voters. You just don't have that. You don't have fundraising via the internet. Some members of parliament have email magazines, and they'll kind of update their supporters about their activities, but I mean, they're kind of unsophisticated. They don't update their websites often, so it's just that they haven't really started using these tools to interact with their supporters. But that's only one side of it. The other side of it is you have to look at the role that Japan's mainstream media plays. Of course, we're used to discussions here and all these woeful discussions. Like what we saw last week. What's the future of old media? Where is it going? Is it going to survive? What are we going to have? Are we still going to have newspapers? Japan isn't having that discussion. When you look at Yomiuri and Asahi, the two biggest Japanese newspapers, they have subscriber bases well over 10 million people. And that's just the economics aren't there. They have no incentive to start giving away their information. And information in Japan hasn't quite gotten to the point where it wants to be free. And so that's pretty much a standard. I mean, and we talk about linking and this kind of linking culture. If the links aren't there, or if you don't put, I mean, Japanese newspapers put a very small portion of their content online. I found that, I mean, I had a lot more to write about when I was actually based in Japan because I could open up a newspaper and there'd be these long political analyses that were, by someone well known that just wouldn't be online. You couldn't find it online. So you'd get these short snippets online and the links expire very quickly. So, I'll write a post, and I'm sure that if I go back to posts I wrote last week, the links will have expired already. And it makes it really hard to blog. I mean, you look at how blogs function in the United States, there's very much a symbiotic relationship with the mainstream media. For all the people talk about this sort of antagonistic relationship, bloggers do need mainstream media providing their content and providing the links and keeping it there. And the Japanese newspapers have no incentive to do that. You don't see that kind of symbiotic relationship. And it's the same thing with monthly and weekly magazines. They're even worse than the newspapers because they basically just put their table of contents online. And so if you read a hard copy, then you can write about it, but of course you can't link to it. And so it's dependent on people being able to find it. So there are a lot of handicaps to being a blogger about Japanese politics, whether you're writing in English or Japanese. Just it's not there. But the other aspect of it, other than the financial side of it, because they just don't have an incentive to share their content, the other side of it, the role played by the mainstream media in Japanese life is just different than the role American media has played. And obviously American media is part of the American establishment in a way, but it certainly has an antagonistic relationship at times. And there's certainly a watchman ethic to what media does. I mean, there's a lot of watching what people in Washington are doing and making and keeping them accountable, or at least in theory, that's what they should be doing. Japanese, you know, television, newspapers, they are very much a part of the establishment and become, they get to the point where they're so closely connected to the politicians they're supposed to be covering that information gets withheld. They start playing political roles. I mean, you look last year, there was this move for a grand coalition between the governing LDP and the opposition Democrats, and it was being orchestrated by Watanabe Sunyo, who's the chairman of the Yomiuri Group and is this big fixer in the political system. And he started as a political journalist and moved his way up to the top. And now he is, I mean, he really plays an important role in Japanese politics. And that, just the whole way that media relates to politics is different. And therefore, it makes it really, so not only is it hard for bloggers to watch media as they do in the United States, it's also hard for bloggers to watch politicians because they're not getting the information that would otherwise be provided by the media. So bloggers can't really be watchmen of the watchmen, and they can't watch the government, and they can't raise these questions. There's no Japanese Joshua Marshall. You don't have that sort of quasi-establishment role for Japanese bloggers. And in the end, it ends up being a lot of people talking to themselves, and there's not really, you know, things don't get picked up by the mainstream media. You won't have a story that some Japanese blogger is pursuing that the media will start talking about. I mean, it's very much just talking to each other. And so, of course, not surprisingly, if you look at the current Diet session underway, both members from both parties have actually submitted a bill that will restrict or is actually dangerous to publishing on the internet because it calls for ISPs and website managers to patrol their content in the name of protecting the children. And I mean, there's been nary a peep about this. There's been maybe one mainstream news article about this. I mean, it's just not, you know, the media would be happy to see much less publishing on the internet. It doesn't hurt them. And so just to close, just about kind of my own experience as an English language blogger about Japanese politics, there's a small group of us. I mean, I would say that there are probably maybe half dozen of us who write on a daily or every other day, you know, basis following events in Japan, and we're pretty much profiting from the decline of American news media. I mean, we're as all these bureaus close, and this is a phenomenon I think you see with other countries as well, where you have people who have lived in a certain country for a long time, know the politics, might not be engaged in it professionally, but feel they know enough, so they start a blog and they start covering. You know, I know there's a blogger who writes about French politics who is extraordinary. I mean, and I think you see that because you're not getting, if you want that kind of daily coverage of the politics of another country, you're not getting it really from American newspapers. Maybe you'll get it when something big happens, you'll get a story, but the way we cover events abroad, I think, has changed. And so, you know, we have kind of a niche to fill now because the demand for this information is still there. And so, I mean, and I guess that gets to Devin's point about what do Americans actually know about the world and how is that affecting our democracy. I mean, hopefully, I mean, this is one role that English language bloggers can play in actually trying to keep the American public informed. I mean, I know what my readership is, so I know that it's not the general public who's being informed, but I certainly hope that and think that my readers actually get something out of it, that they get analysis of Japanese politics that you're not really finding in other sources now. So I'll close on that note and just, you know, that there is a role to, you know, we are out there writing. It's just we're filling a role that the media has really left open.
Well, now's a good time to get the political scientist's take on what we've heard here tonight.
Well, the nice thing about being a political scientist is not only do we not know very much, everyone knows we don't know very much. So I'll be relatively brief because I'm interested in what kinds of things and questions you all have. My own interest, though, and it's sparked especially by what's been said here so far, is in part around this notion that David talked about, the notion of affordances. How do changes in the way the environment is make some things easier and some things more difficult? Not that they determine them, just that they make it easier. And in particular, from a political standpoint, when you think about democracy, if you had a timeline of human history, and then you try to figure out how long have people organized themselves democratically, that period wouldn't even be as wide as my fingernail. I mean, it would be virtually non-existent. The probability of throwing a dart at that line and finding a democratic period is measure zero, basically, from a mathematical standpoint. And to what extent are then, well, let me, one more thing. Democracy, at least as I understand it, and I think most political theorists understand it, depends very, very deeply on information. Information is what lets us have preferences. It lets us express those preferences through voting. It does a whole set of things. And when you change the nature of information, as clearly these new media are doing in non-trivial ways, I would argue, it's going to change, I think, or change the affordances for the kind of political system we live in. And one of the interesting things about comparing, to my mind anyway, Korea, or looking at Korea, looking at the United States, is Korea is a country which has done things that are nothing less than miraculous since the end of the Korean conflict, both economically and politically. Some would argue, we did as early as this afternoon, that in many regards, Korea is more democratic than the United States. Perhaps that, but it's more democratic in the sense that there are more ways for opinions and for preferences to be expressed through things like blogs, voting, and so on. But what perhaps Korea lacks at this point are the kinds of mature institutions that one might, I would argue anyway, the United States has. But of course, those institutions are based upon a notion of deliberation. The things sort of go slowly, reflectively. And yet the point that I think several folks have made about blogs is their comparative advantage is they're quick, they're fast. And of course, human beings are good at dealing over a range of timescales, but very fast timescales and very long timescales, unless perhaps you're Chinese, we're not very good at doing. We tend to respond relatively quickly and well to more intermediate levels of time constants. And so all these things happening in the so-called new media, blogging being or blogs being one of them, you have to ask yourself the question, what does that say about the kind of political system that's going to work well in that information environment? Because it's a very different information environment in 2008 than what people lived in 1776, 1800, and so on. And so that's a question. It's a question really more for you. I don't really know the answers, but I think that looking for those answers is absolutely fascinating. Moreover, we know that blogging is I think we know that the blogs are having an impact. One of the things that I, as a political scientist, find is fascinating in the Annenberg tracking poll that's being done right now in the presidential election, these are early results that probably will turn out to be wrong, but more young people, according to the results there, have tried to change someone else's political opinion than have older people, which to a political scientist is kind of a surprising thing. And yet, when you think about it, one of the things that blogs and other forms of these new media can do, YouTube, is actually have arguments. Could Barack Obama's speech, for example, on race have had the effectiveness that it did had there not been a YouTube where people could come and see it over and over again in more or less its entirety? Because that's a complicated speech by conventional media standards. And I think you could make the same argument for parts of the campaign. So this is what I think we mean by affordances. In the same way, I think David was talking about the fact that people are willingly and selflessly sharing. This is what Benkler talks about as shared production. That shared production in this instance is very much like what we political scientists call mobilization. How is it you get people to do something collectively that they hadn't been doing? And you look at Korea, anyone who was in South Korea during the time of the World Cup games and saw all the people wearing red T-shirts and finally coming down into City Hall Square, that was a pretty amazing phenomenon. And it wasn't too much longer, too much later after that, that after the U.S. military folks accidentally, at least by what they decided, killed two young Korean, I think, girls, and this became political mobilization. Then the same technology, using cell phones, getting people networked together to talk, created a political movement. And at least according to the research that Jung Woo Han has done, it suggests that that's ultimately what may have led to No Myung-hun's election, the ability to mobilize at the last minute using cell phones. And I would argue, I'm not sure David would agree, that some of what Howard Dean can campaign did was borrowing technology developed in Korea to try to take some of these new networked information technologies and bring them into the U.S. election side of things. So that's a very interesting, to me, kind of tech transfer that's different than what we normally think about with regard to politics. The U.S., of course, responded, and what they did is create what I guess the embassy called Cafe USA, which is a mechanism that young Koreans can actually send email to the U.S. embassy and try to get responses back from the U.S. embassy. And we've got a study going on now trying to determine how effective, if at all, that actually is having. But this is using sort of blogging technology through Naver.com to actually try to change people's perceptions of the United States government using some of these techniques. And again, focusing on the generational differences, because probably nowhere is that clearer than in Korea, that the gap in a whole lot of ways between younger generation and older generation. Last point I want to make before letting go of what I'm talking about is just to ask or kind of problematize the notion of accountability, because with the multiple identities, the question of anonymity, all sorts of things, how do we have democratic accountability of the sort that we initially understood? And the tip of the iceberg here is all the disagreements and problems around e-voting. Many of those problems, of course, have been exposed via the blogosphere. But at the same time, some of those problems come as a consequence of network technologies that make the blogosphere possible. So e-voting is much more vulnerable for the very reasons that it is networked. If it weren't networked, you could have corruption, but hopefully the corruption is somewhat more localized than it would be in this kind of thing. So these are the kinds of issues that I think some political scientists think about and want to understand better. And from my perspective, there are probably no better two laboratories than South Korea and the United States to look at this. We have a journalist who's now pursuing a PhD at Syracuse University, and she worked for the Korea Herald, Hyun-Jun Soo, and she covered the six-party talks for both out of Beijing and out of Pyongyang for a while for the Korea Herald. And I asked her about blogging in Korea versus Japan, and her response was interesting, it probably is right, and it is that the reason that blogs have been so effective in Korea and less so in Japan, from her perspective, was not so much that it was the legal system, although that's certainly important, but that for the younger generation, the newspapers in Korea were thought to be highly conservative. And so this provided them something to react against, as opposed to what was going on perhaps in Japan, or the way the conventional media were perceived in Japan. So this, again, is an example of, I think, both of how this stuff gets politicized in really interesting ways, creates new mobilization or shared production, if you will. And it's something I don't think we understand much about at all. But as at least those of us who have an interest in this would like to see, where might this be going? And I think it isn't necessarily going where it is right now. It's going to a lot of interesting things happening. Thanks.
Sure. And I think now we're going to see some... We've been talking about blogs in the abstract, but now we're going to see some concrete examples.
Well, we'll see concrete examples of social networking sites.
Okay.
Because rather than talking about blogs, I'll be talking about social networking sites such as SciWorld Korea, SciWorld US, and Facebook. And I'm interested in these sites because they seek to contain, and I mean this in all modes of the word contain, blogs. So I call them the iPhones of Web 2.0. And so there's two points that I want to make today in these opening comments. And one, the first one is that social networking sites are in many ways gated communities. And so what they do is try to create so-called free or safe spaces by creating concrete boundaries. And these are interestingly both national and language-based, as well as sort of fractured within those as well. And the second point I want to make is that blogs change when they're on social networks. And they change precisely because they're suddenly in dialogue with other forms of quasi-public and private writing, right? So from wall postings, which are basically sort of public displays of affection or connection, to news feeds, which are really intriguingly sort of involuntary or quasi-voluntary tracking of users, to really private comments, which are more ephemeral, right? The chats that are being more and more enabled. Okay. So in the first instance, the notion of these social networks is resonating with gated communities. What I find really intriguing is the ways in which these social networking sites really cut up the World Wide Web in intriguing ways. And they do this by their privacy settings and also differences between national and various national sites. And I want to get through this through a really brief comparison of CyWorld and Facebook. And unfortunately, I think I'm tied here, right? I have the one roaming mic that doesn't roam. Okay, I can stay here. Yeah, we tried this before. I'm like, can't do this. All right, I think actually it'll go through. Yes. I'm comfortable just taking this off and just going over there. Oh, sorry. Oh, it's okay. Let me just get this up. So I'm just going to show a couple of slides, so it's not a... this is a site that I think many of you are familiar with. So this is a typical CyWorld site, CyWorld Korea site from 2004, right? And so... allegedly, 90% of all South Koreans under 20 are on CyWorld, called CyHolics. Now, what's interesting is that CyWorld also released a U.S. version in 2006. And what's interesting about this version, which I can just put up as well, is that when it came out, what it had in place, and here's a rough version of the U.S. 2004 version, 2006 version, is that it had features of a much earlier South Korean CyWorld. So a lot of people who started using this, who were used to the Korean site, felt that it was very limited. But there was also a sense that this should really kick MySpace's butt, right? Because CyWorld is much better than... MySpace, allegedly. It's a much cleaner interface. Of course, as you can tell, though, it's also a lot more cutesy, right? And there's this community manager that emails me now and then, lets me know various things are happening. But what's interesting as well, too, is you join clubs, not groups. But what was interesting as well, this whole notion of having an avatar and a mini homepage is actually much closer to the early versions of the World Wide Web, things like Neil Stephenson. And what was intriguing, though, is that even though you had these avatars, what you had them next to were photographs and videos that were supposed to be indexical, right? So there was a sense that, oh, here was this space in which you could create things, but it was always tied to some sort of quote-unquote authentic identity, which you could see through these photographs. Now, what I find really intriguing is that in going global, CyWorld decided, because there's also CyWorld China sites as well, the CyWorld sites can't speak to each other. So if you're on CyWorld US, you can't see the sites in CyWorld Korea. So each language community is completely separate. And this isn't due to a technological barrier. So my students, for instance, can post in Hangul in the English site. So it's not a technological barrier, but rather an interesting sort of national reinscription. But what's intriguing to me now is that the CyWorld US site has really mutated from something like this and moved towards something that looks a lot more like Facebook. And so here you see a CyWorld site from one of my students. You see here's her little avatar. But as well, there's just the look and feel of it, as well the very wall postings are very much taking up the rhetoric of Facebook. And just to make that clear, let me just show you a Facebook site of one of my other students. And you can see, like, down to the fonts and the colorings, the similarities that are merging in these two different sites. Now, what's intriguing about this is that, for one thing, CyWorld US is not very popular. It's taken a long time for it to take off, and it's unclear that it really will. But what's intriguing for me about this as well is the sort of accidental ways in which nations take up various social networking sites. So Orkut, which was started by a Google employee and later sanctioned by a Google employee, started off in the U.S. and has gone nowhere in the U.S., but is apparently very popular in Brazil. And so there's all these really intriguing sort of national resonances which are actually unexpected. And I think this unexpected nature of it is what's really intriguing. But what I would also point out is that these stabilities are really just temporary. And one of the most intriguing things I think about working with the World Wide Web is the fact that what the World Wide Web engenders is this incredible desire for more, for change. But it can't be contained in these very sites that try to contain them. So this is why every tech company is always in danger, but also, therefore, a really interesting dynamic of what can be captured if we take this desire for change and dynamicism seriously. But a couple of other things that I find interesting about social networking sites is that they take what could be looked at as surveillance, news feeds, and turn them into a feature that makes people want to read more. Right, so the problem is people don't post enough. So how do you get people to post events, which means more people will go to your site? You turn their involuntary actions into news. So I find that sort of involuntary, along with the voluntary spread of information, to be very intriguing. And also in terms of Facebook and the notion of a gated community, what I find very important is that Facebook was started by Matt Zuckerberg, right, who was at Harvard at the time. And the idea was you could let other Harvard sophomores look at you and see where you are. Now, when Facebook first came up, there were very forceful privacy settings. So if you were a student at Texas A&M, for instance, you could see a Harvard profile if you were invited to a friend, but you couldn't see it globally. And so one of the reasons why it was considered to be so safe, I would argue, is because it takes that, you know, sort of a homey sense of community that liberal arts colleges and Ivy League colleges put together or for something for which we pay so dearly and made it available at a much larger scale. But I have some other comments about questions of what changes, but I'm going to leave those just so we can move on.
Since we have almost run out of time and it's time to open the floor for discussions, I'm actually glad because I'm the only one here, I think, who doesn't really have a statement to make. I would like a more, I'd rather point out links, convergences and divergences in the different perspectives that we are fortunate enough tonight to have. What I find interesting, particularly in Wendy's talk about this presentation on social networking, is the fact that when you talk about blog, you don't only talk, you're not exclusively talking about blogging. In Korea is an interesting case in particular. When you speak about Korean online culture, it's very tempting to recontextualize all these channels, these media. One has to bear in mind that internet culture in Korea is already something old. It developed very quickly. It spread very fast to the point that in many ways it's tempting to see Korea as the laboratory for all things internet. When you speak about broadband culture, for a long time, Korea was the leader. That was the leading market, the leading, if you want, the leading, the top space for all these things. And so to give you some figures, I always get my fingers wrong, so I have to take a look at my papers. The population of Korea is about 48 million, and now you have 33 million internet users, most of which are connected via broadband. So for years, that was really one of the distinctive features of internet culture. It's really fast, so you end up, as a result, you end up having these channels, these websites that are heavily graphic, and one of the distinctive features of Cyworld, and one of the reasons why you have phenomena such as Cyworld or massively multiplayer online game, and I'll come back to this a little later if I have the time, is it was made possible because of this technology. At the time of dial-up, there's no way you're going to have these very heavy graphic pages. That was at some point AOL, I think, exploited this kind of things. We all know where it went, not very far. In Korea, it still persists, and because of this level of broadband, it's actually a market that's very difficult to penetrate. And we speak often about the globalization of Google, like these worldwide multinational, transnational companies such as Google, but then you have Korea, and that's not a country where Google is a leader. Stuart was mentioning a little earlier in the conversation we had earlier that Naver is the fourth largest web portal worldwide, and it's a Korean language web portal, and Korean, as you know, is maybe not the most popular language. So that points out, when you look at Korean online culture, Korean blogging, or whatever, you see a lot of the limits of globalization, of the globalized of internet in general. So that's one of the things I wanted to point out. And also, see, a lot of the blogging is not technically, strictly speaking, blogging in Korea. And I think that's what we could see via Sawa. It's done in other ways. It's not just, okay, so this is about my girlfriend, this is about my life, or my boss, or my company, or about gadgets. In South Korea, blogging is almost immediately linked to others. It's not self-expression. As soon as you express yourself, you're in a public space. And I think that's one of the interesting things when you talk about blogging, and you have this tension between, and that's not specific to Korea, you have this tension between the public sphere and the private sphere. Like, people love to talk about self-expression these days, and one of the good things about blogging, and also people say, or technologists say, is that it's good to express yourself, right? But it's not only about expressing yourself, it's about creating new social spaces. And Korea, in that way, is very interesting, because you have the formation of factions, and therefore you also have phenomena of what is now popularly called cyber violence. You have tribes, you have groups that track what you're doing, and it has influences on reality. Now, I saw this discussion recently on the ethical blogger project, the blogosphere, the validity of the expression. Blogosphere gives the idea of a closed doors kind of virtual, all-encompassing world that could be kind of separate from reality. But if you take a look at what happened in the past few years in South Korea, what do you have? You have groups of netizens who find information on people, who track them down in real life, and have them kicked out of universities. I mean, like, there's this very famous anecdote about this woman who's now known as the dog poop girl. She let her dog poop in the subway, and she got a few weeks later, she was probably one of the most searched name on Korean web portals. Next thing you know, she was kicked out. So online life in Korea has a strong impact on reality. I think I should really close my comments with this and open the floor to discussion and other questions, as I'm sure you will.
Thank you. Now we'll entertain questions from the audience. I just ask that you wait until the microphone comes over to you. Does anyone like to ask a question?
Ms. Chun described the social networks as gated communities. I would like to know if the panel thinks the same applies to blogging communities as well. And if so, is it a matter more of language or culture? And to take an example, I will assume your Mr. Harris blog is in English. I don't know. I haven't visited. But would a Japanese person who doesn't speak English be interested in learning what you have to say about Japanese politics?
Actually, yeah, I have Japanese language blogs that link to me and actually have translated portions of bits that I've written for their audiences. So I guess you have people who are multilingual who can borrow from that. And I have French readers I know of because I've had links from French sites and German sites. So yeah, I mean, there is a... I guess those barriers aren't really there. And I mean, I guess what it comes down to is that, I mean, there is demand for this information regardless of the source. And so I end up having, I mean, I've had some great exchanges with people from, diplomats from other countries who just, need to know what's happening in Japanese politics and send me emails and we end up talking a lot. So yeah, I find that, if anything, blogging's been a great way to open horizons instead of put up barriers. I mean, it's almost phenomenal what I've seen in the year and a half I've been doing this.
Can I answer that? Oh, just, sure. a quick thought. We had Second Life evangelists at our panel, which was it was inspiring and very interesting. And one of the arguments that the Second Life, I'm not going to say click, the Second Life advocates say is that to some degree, Second Life is a bit more open because people are sort of milling around and there's a cacophony of languages in one place. So they're making the argument there is actually more interaction because you just sort of literally wander around and you can hear people, talking different languages. If you can understand it, it's a different story.
Question for David. You mentioned the transparency of blogs and also that the political views were often magnified. And so that brings us to the question of flaming online. And I wanted to ask about sort of the, and any other panelists as well, how this phenomenon is evolving on a legal basis in terms of freedom of speech and libel and such, because clearly with anonymous blogs and discussion boards and things like that, the ability of a self-publishing journalist to say anything and everything online is quite different than it is in offline publishing, where there's a newspaper or a magazine that might be sued. And obviously we have, we're talking about a worldwide electronic simultaneous newspaper. Anybody can read anywhere. Whilst with, offline publishing, the libel laws in the UK or the Eurozone are quite different than they are in this country, as are the enforcement of freedom of speech. I asked this question because a couple months ago I wrote a column for the Korea Times about comfort women and almost immediately got a huge anonymous, very mean-spirited flame on a site called Japan Probe. You may be familiar with the site, and they accused me of this and that and the other thing. And I thought, boy, this is a really strong comment. And I tried to figure out who it was. And, of course, it was some anonymous discussion board poster. And not that I was going to sue the guy, but I couldn't if I wanted to. Whilst if the Prime Minister of Japan wanted to sue the Korea Times, he could have done so. So this is just a question about the sort of the legal issues and the freedom of speech issues as it relates to this evolving phenomenon of blogs. Sorry for talking so long.
I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not competent to answer the question.
Well, Korea has the Korea Internet Safety commission. And I think they're, like in many things, again, software-wise or internet-wise, it was kind of groundbreaking in that respect. Problems emerged very quickly, like in Korea as the broadband networks expanded. So when it came to flaming, they were also very, they did that very early. So they set up a number of commissions. But to answer directly your questions, there's the number of lawsuits has greatly increased. I think we're reaching the 50,000 number of complaints about sexual harassment in particular. So things are getting done, but there's always this tension, this duality between how fast people are at developing this aspect of technology and the legal system as well. I mean, the U.S. is facing the same issues with copyrights when it comes to downloading. And David wants...
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. Please.
I
just hit my microphone. I'm incompetent at wearing a microphone.
Right. So yeah, there are some measures taken against flaming. Now the efficiency of that, I think it's still not quite there. Last year there was a number of suicides of celebrities, pop stars related to. Flaming raised the question seriously. So I think these laws are debated. Maybe you would know about this. Some laws are debated, are currently being discussed to limit this phenomenon. But so far, I haven't really seen any effects on it.
I do want to. I think the discussion of anonymity is threading its way through here, and I can't help you with the law at all. I mean, other than to say, libel laws apply online in the U.S. as they do offline. But I think we should be really careful about assuming that there is an important and deep connection between permitting anonymity and libel laws. I think in this case, what we're really suffering from is finding out what free speech looks like. And it's not always pretty, and sometimes it's really hurtful and harmful to people. And sometimes, so flaming has become, flaming generally is handled on the web through social norms of various sorts. It's rarely used by law. When people have terrible misunderstandings written about them, as you did in response to your piece, generally, we don't sue. In such a case, anonymity doesn't really matter. It doesn't help you want to find out who said that. Why? What are you going to do? It doesn't help you. What would help more, perhaps, is to know that this, find out not who the identity of this person is in the real world, because you're not going to go up to him or her and slap a lawsuit on them or threaten them or bully them. I mean, that's not what you're intending. It would be more useful, perhaps, if there were a pseudonym and you could see other things that this person said, and you can see, why does this person have such a, you know, why this issue? Why? What's behind this? But that, you don't need to know the person's name for that. You just need to know what else she or he has written. Anonymity turns out, I think, to be misunderstood in the real world. We are anonymous by default in the real world. I don't have the right to ask you who you are, even in this setting. If I were to say to you, hey, identify yourself, and I want to see a passport, and it better be... I don't have the right to do that. Anonymity is the default in the real world. In order to break anonymity, to demand anonymity, I have to have special justification, special circumstances, be in a special role if I'm a police officer and I have reason I can. Anonymity is hugely important in the real world. It's assumed. It's taken for granted. The danger is that on the web, as we look for accountability, because frequently we don't like the way free speech looks, we end up, in order to do that systemically, we have to alter the system in a way that leaves it open to the most flagrant abuse by bad actors, whether they're bad governments or bad corporations or whatever. And so we would pay a huge price in order to be able to track down the occasional serious abuser who we do want to track down. So I'd like to see I'd like to see anonymity not assumed to be, I'm not saying you're doing this, not assumed to be the culprit behind the abuses of free speech.
Can I comment on that real quick? One of the points
I thought you might.
Thanks. The sneezing professor. Sneezing panda, we have a sneezing professor. One of the points that Phil Rosedale made from Second Life was that if people spend so much time investing in these online identities, that eventually they'll want to protect their integrity and that they'll want to be credible, decent citizens online. That's a very optimistic viewpoint, but I think that it's worth considering. And another point is that, you know, with more power and the more reach you have, the more, theoretically, the more your blog will become self-correcting because more people are viewing it and therefore will attack you if you say something incorrect or you know, off the wall. And I think, speaking of off the wall, I think that if you sound off the wall and like a nutcase, people will dismiss you as being such. And this, you know, there's freedom of speech, and then there's, you know, an ethical use of the freedom of speech. And this whole conversation kind of reminds me of a thing that I witnessed in Japan when I lived in Tokyo, was the emergence of a cell phone culture. You know, when this new technology was introduced to society, people were sort of scrambling. How do we do this with etiquette and in a nice way? And one of the ways they did it was by putting, do not use your cell phone here because it will affect pacemakers and other gadgets, so turn it off. Well, I really, you know, it's suspect whether that was really the reason why they asked you to turn your cell phone off. But the real, you know, I think a lot of people assume that they just wanted you to have some common sense and some manners. They're trying to figure out justification.
Just a quick comment, because I'm not sure I completely agree with you, David, because my sense is that most of our, at least ordinary language sense of laws, is that identity is ultimately kind of a rigid designator, at least in a nosic sense, that we know that you're not going to be the nearest. You disagree?
I do. But
yeah, okay, anyway. So the notion is that if we can have identities and shed them and bring them back on again, I think that's part of what you're asking about there. And do the laws actually adequately capture that? I don't know. But I do think that identities where you can have multiple ones, for example, in the Second Life example, might well be worthwhile to invest a lot in an identity that was truthful, honest, and a good kind of person. But it might equally be well advised, once you have that identity, to invest in another kind of nasty one just because it's fun to have it. And it doesn't really cost you anything because it's a separate identity. Anyway, you have a response.
I've spoken a great deal.
Oh, just complete along the lines, but slightly differently. Speaking as a former engineer, I find it really strange that people think the World Wide Web is anonymous, right? Because you have an IP address, it comes back to you. Google stores every search and ties it to an IP address. I think that there are questions of what should be erased. It's not why is the default always storing, and that's an interesting question. But I think that this whole idea of it being as a default, technological default, anonymous, is very strange.
Well, my computer has an IP address, which, by the way, my ISP changes against my will quite frequently. I don't, but that ties a post to the
IP
computer.
Address, right.
Doesn't tie it to me.
If you didn't spoof your MAC address. I mean, even right. Then
plus
you don't know. You
can, and there's spoofing. But even if I don't, those, yeah, it doesn't
exactly.
Come back to me. It comes
no,
back to a computer.
There's more ways of tracking at the same time that are in place versus you just saying something out there. And so in other words, there are different modes of accountability. And what I find really intriguing is precisely the ways in which networks. For instance, when you're on a computer, your computer is constantly sending back and forth information, right? It acts promiscuously. You read everything that happens in a network, and you actively delete what is not directly given to your IP address. There is the sociability and an intriguing ways in which we can rethink social networking precisely if we take it at that level and move away from the notion of anonymity, but really think through tracking.
Could you say more? Because I'm not understanding. Are you suggesting that, first of all, I'm still not convinced that I'm not fundamentally anonymous when I use a computer. I understand the computer isn't. If you manage to go through the various legal and get the subpoenas in order to track which IP, which is extraordinarily difficult but can be done, you've now proved that the packet came from this computer. And there's still a case to be made, especially in a lot of public computers, that we don't know who did it. So I'm not sure at the engineering level what you're claiming about anonymity. I'm not sure
right.
What the social implication is that you're pointing to.
Well, what I would argue, but I'm sorry, there was another question, so I don't want us to get sidetracked into this.
I think that we can stay on.
Okay.
I promise not to reply.
No, but I actually do think that the level, you're absolutely right. There is a disconnect between one's computer and oneself. As well, there are ways in
against
which
my will on occasion, but yes.
Yes, and I also think that one of the most intriguing ways to have any degree of privacy on the web is by being completely public and by proliferating one's identity ad infinitum. That is a very intriguing and important way that my students, for instance, manage to have some sort of quote-unquote privacy. But I don't think it's quite privacy there. But what I'm arguing as well is your computer, when you are, why do we think we control interactivity means that our computers just wait for us to click something and then it goes off and gets exactly what we want, and somehow we're not seen in this. But also, if you take networking sites seriously, or the way networks work, when you're, for instance, on an Ethernet bus, you can see all the traffic that goes through, right? On your networking card is reading in all the packets around it. But it then actively erases those that are not directly addressed to it, right? And what's interesting is different operating systems give you different access to it. So, for instance, under Linux, I can run my wireless card promiscuously, but I can't do that under Windows. But what if we think now that our computers are fundamentally involved in this exchange of information that we only know a tiny bit of? How then do we start thinking of being in public, or how, what sort of interactions are made possible and that we're always engaged in once we're on a network?
Thanks very much. I recently read a story in the New York Times that was last weekend about the stress experienced by bloggers working to a 24/7 news cycle. I'm just curious, you know, what the life is like to be a political blogger. And I'm thinking about, you know, like Tories or, you know, Steve Clemons, you know. And how much time do you spend on updating and gathering information? And how do you finance your operations? And, you know, I mean, how you know, can a political blogger make a living? I'm just curious.
Well, I'm not making a living from it. I mean, this is really kind of it's almost something before I'm probably going to go down an academic path. So this is really just keeping me busy before I do that. And I actually started blogging when I was working for a member of the Japanese Diet, and that was kind of originally it was going to be I'd be noting things that I saw, and then I realized I wasn't seeing anything, and I ended up reading a lot, and then just, you know, over the course of the day thinking about issues in Japanese politics and writing about it. And so it was, you know, it was kind of in the morning, in the evening, and whenever I could read the news. And now for the last 7 months, you know, I've been doing it almost full time, and that's, you know, like constantly just following news. I mean, and when I read that, I laughed when I read that New York Times article, because I can't say I'm quite there yet, but it's, I mean, and actually, I guess thanks or no thanks to Google Reader. I mean, it's just the amount of information I can process now without having to go to separate websites. I mean, it's just, it's a blessing and a curse, I guess. I mean, there's the amount of time you could spend on it is theoretically unlimited. I mean, there's always new sources to look for, and I mean, even with Japanese newspapers putting limited amounts of information online, there's still more than enough, you know, and more than I can read in a day. So it's a lot of time. I can't even put a number on it, but it's a lot of time.
Can I answer that real quick? Sorry. I think 3 points. One, the New York Times model is you're attached to a newspaper, and you have your life is supported by a major institution like that. That's one type, which begs the question of why is a blogger blogging for a major newspaper? It seems to contradict a lot of what blogging is all about. Second point, I had the chance to meet Josh Marshall just a couple of weeks ago, and he funds himself through advertising. I mean, it's just, you know, it's a business model. And the third point, real quick, is just blogging is another part of your outreach. I mean, my area is think tankery or foundation world or nonprofits, that world. When I go to foundations to look for funding, I say, and the findings will be on the blog, and there will be a blog devoted to the subject, and so forth.
Actually, let me just add one more point about that, because actually, in a way, my blog's almost become just a platform for my other activities. So now I have articles in other places. I have other people who have come and asked me to write things for them through the blog. So it's almost, it's almost turning into my research notes, and I end up will take things that I write and develop into an article, and will be contacted for other reasons. So it's almost, that's why, I mean, I almost don't think of myself as a blogger primarily, because I'm using it as a platform for other activities. And actually, I think that's one difference, again, another difference between U.S. blogging culture and Japanese blogging culture, is that I just don't think there's anyone who's using a blog as almost kind of a springboard into respectability and into, or at least I hope I've gained a certain amount of respectability. I'm not going to speak for my readers, but and I just, you don't see that in Japan. I mean, like I said, I think bloggers just end up talking to themselves, and it's not, they're not patched into the establishment in any way.
We're not Mike Arrington, one of the examples they use from TechCrunch. We don't have 500,000 readers, and we're not making $1.5 million a year. I'm just going to speak for the panel here,
yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
So I'm a writer, I'm sort of an academic, and I spend maybe an hour a day blogging, and my word would not be stressful. I would say I am incredibly overstimulated by the blogging community. The pace of ideas, the things to think about is in fact overwhelming. So I actually do have a little trouble going to sleep because I'm still thinking about that last thing I read, and when I wake up, I start thinking about, you know, what I, and making a note, and it's incredibly intellectually overstimulating. Yeah. God bless it.
And you know, and actually for me, blogging about Japan from here means, I mean, I try to, you know, like I'm staying up until 2 a.m. just so I can see if there's a new story that's coming out in Japan. I want to be up for it so I can write about it, or at least see what people are saying about it. You know, first thing I, you know, in the morning, I'm checking to see if people, you know, like what people are saying about what I wrote the previous night before going to sleep. That's actually been particularly stressful. Just, you know, writing about things that are happening, you know, 12 hours, you know, 12 hours into the future, I guess. That's another dimension of it too. The time dimension for me is difficult, and just, you know, not wanting to miss a story that's happening because I'm sleeping.
Got it bad.
Yeah.
I'm curious to hear the comparison between South Korea and Japan, because I would think of them as probably being the two most advanced countries in the world technologically, at least if you think in terms of cell phones and the internet. I mean, oftentimes people say Japan is 2 years ahead of the U.S., and I think you can see that particularly like with cell phones. And yet, on the one hand, it seems like South Korea, we have a very active, like, was it 90% under 20 years old? And it sounds a little bit with Japan that it's semi-restrictive. So I'm curious, like, moving forward, I mean, what lessons are there that maybe the U.S. can pick up? Like, are we going to be more like Korea? Are we going to be like Japan if we do, you know, have greater broadband access? And I'm particularly interested, like, you know, economically, I mean, like, how the private sector will influence that. Because, like, in Korea, it's, what, a $1 billion industry now, the virtual world. And then you have Second Life, which is also, like, part of this new Web 3.0, where instead of just like the advertisers put up ads, now you have to pay to participate. So you can fly around Second Life, but if you really want to participate, you have to pay money. So I'm curious, you know, moving forward, what lessons we can take thinking about the U.S. from Korea and Japan.
Japan, I don't know. From Korea, I spoke about the specificities of Korean online culture, and I think in some ways when it comes to the business of leisure, namely video games, I think we're already walking in the same direction. Like in recent years, you've had the boom of Blizzard. Those of you who follow business news related to a video game know that there was this recent transaction. It was we're talking about, do you know the amount of the merger? $28 billion. Merger. We're talking big money there, and so in that respect, Korea was definitely groundbreaking, and interestingly, because of a restriction, because for years, when it came to video games, there was a ban on Japanese imports. So what happened in Japan? You had this huge development of console culture. You have like these video games that we all enjoy playing at times, but in Korea, instead, since there was no console, they developed online video games, and these online video games, online-based video games, allow you to connect with other users, and once again, that brings us to the social aspect of the online life in Korea. So I think in this respect, Korea is kind of setting a trend. It's very interesting to observe the behavior of video game consumers in Korea, because very often, a couple of years later, you observe similarities in what happens in the U.S. market. And what happened with Lineage, for example, was the first success of a massively multiplayer online role-playing game, I get it right, happened a few years later in the U.S. with World of Warcraft. So I think in this sense, you get we're more walking in similar directions. About Japan, I'm not so sure why you're speaking about institutionalization, mainstream, being more mainstream. I don't know exactly.
There's one thing, actually, one kind of factor shaping why Web 2.0 politics just doesn't exist in Japan or is so limited. And I think there's a political culture element to it. I don't want to attribute too much to it, but I certainly think it's part of it. I mean, I think blogging is a very American activity. I think it has roots in pamphleteering during the American Revolution. I think that democracy is a marketplace of ideas, and anyone who has an idea can put it out there. And there's a certain meritocracy, and the people who have good ideas are recognized for them. And there's a constant discussion. I think that's a very American thing. Japanese democracy, I don't think, just doesn't function that way. And so I don't want to go too far with that, because obviously, I mean, I do think there'll be a growth in blogging, and I think as the institutional factors change, you'll see more of it. But there's still a certain reluctance, I think, to just shout out your opinion to the world and let other people judge it and feel confident enough in shouting out your opinions with other people and not being shy about that. And So I don't think that's going to change nearly as much as some of the structural or institutional factors are going to change. There's always going to be a certain reticence in Japanese bloggers when it comes to politics and how they use that to interact with politicians or with other citizens.
Time for one more question.
Hold on. Do you foresee the demise of the daily newspapers eventually only like a weekly or a monthly, that somebody picks up the large picture of whatever he wants, but instead of the daily, simply to go to the net? Yeah.
So when you bring bloggers and journalists together to have one of their famous arguments, which has been going on for 3 or 4 years now. The argument, the journalists tend to look out at the blogosphere and see reporters, which I think is a really bizarre way of looking at the blogosphere. Nevertheless, that's what they're saying. And so they think there's a struggle over content, and they look at the content created by bloggers as unedited, irresponsible, inaccurate, no accountability. Most of which is, for most instances, true. I mean, that's what journalists tend not to see. We're seeing it more now, but not to see when they look out is that the editorial function has already moved out onto the internet before blogs. So that people who are on the internet with some constancy, which probably includes at least some of us on the panel, we are getting our news through the internet almost entirely. But it's not necessarily coming from a news site. It's not necessarily coming from NewYorkTimes.com or from a new blogging site. It tends to come throughout the day in the form of emails that you get from friends or from mailing lists, where people will say, a new article was just posted, here's what we think. And so you're getting the information and contextualization. It will come through the blogs that you visit regularly or that might show up in a search. It comes throughout the day in a variety of forms, not necessarily in a page that is an online rival to the printed page. That's already happened. The editorial function has already moved away from the newspapers, for those of us who are online for most of the day. Just one last thing quickly, which was a few months ago I heard the publisher of the Wall Street Journal, this is before Murdoch, say that about a year and a half ago, the Wall Street Journal instructed its reporters not to think of themselves as covering first day news, that they should assume that the news, the readers already got the news, they should be doing the second day coverage, which provides the context and the analysis, all of which is tremendously useful, but the news, the stuff that's actually happening now, the readers probably already had that, already got that. And that's the Wall Street Journal. I mean, that's not a blogger.
In a lot of ways, it's a wire service world, and that you have, and every newspaper is using the same wire services, so you're going to get the headlines. And just in terms of blogging, I mean, I feel like I'm replacing an editorial page. That instead of having someone, an editorial page editor who selects what opinions a reader should get, now you can go to a blog and you can find someone who has an opinion that the screener didn't select. But there's still an element of merit, and you're still judging a person's arguments on the merit. I mean, and bad arguments are ignored, I think, ultimately, or sometimes, but at least the strength, regardless of whether it's right or wrong, well presented arguments, I think, in general, rise to the top. And so, I mean, there's still a need for news. There's still a need for someone out there reporting and providing information. I just think more of it's coming from news services now, and everyone else is left to comment on it and analyze it and figure out what it all means. And so you'll still get a newspaper, I guess. It's just what purpose it's serving is different. Yeah.
I think news itself has been commodified. I think maybe it's add like a cliche to all this nice insight here. But just out of supply and demand, this is an argument that came up in the panel last week. The supply for print advertising is more finite than online, and therefore commands a higher market price. And at least the argument was made last week that the print editions of newspapers are funding the online and blogosphere related to that newspaper. So right now, the money is being made in print. That's at least the argument they made. So there is a business reason to keep print going.
I would like to thank our panel tonight for coming, our audience, and our co-sponsoring organizations, the Japan Society and the Carnegie Council for Ethics in International Affairs. I encourage you to visit the blogs and websites you've heard in tonight's program, especially www.koreasociety.org. So from the entire staff of the Korea Society, I wish you good night. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Members of the Korea Society are notified of all Korea Society events, enjoy discounts on admission to programs, and a complimentary subscription to the Korea Society Journal. Membership may be purchased online at our website, www.koreasociety.org.